Do you like coffee? Do you know that the secret to making truly exceptional coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans? But wait, how long ago was my coffee roasted? Oh, excuse me. Hello?
7 days ago.
That's amazing! Of course, I already knew that because I've switched to Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that they deliver this coffee to your home or office within 7 days of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. They even offer autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And now, they have a special offer for Top 100 Project listeners. You can now save 10% on your first coffee order if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. All one word, the number 100. Maybe you're a listener who's already switched to Sparkplug. They'll honor the code. Heads up, the offer applies to any size coffee order, but does not apply to any of the gear that Sparkplug.com offers. So seriously, what are you waiting for? There's never been a better time to up your coffee game. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey there, all you well-dwelling movie fans, and thank you very much for spending some time with the Next 100 Project. The every Monday analysis, well, not last Monday, but mostly every Monday analysis of various movies, usually classics. If spoilers make you want to murder everyone, you should get out of here now. Or murder everyone. I can't really decide. It's your choice. It's your life. It's a free society. I'm the watcher of cursed videotapes, Ryan Ellis, and here's my plucky blonde beauty of a bride, Beverly.
That's me.
Before we get going into this podcast, I have to correct something because I've always been irritated when other people do this, and I did it myself last week. Jason Blum, the producer of Get Out and many other movies, is not Jason Blum, as I called him repeatedly. I didn't find actual confirmation his name is pronounced Blum or Bloom, but apparently it's Blumhouse. So I'm going for the production company, so I'm going to say that obviously it's Jason Blum. You said it right, I did not, and I hate myself because I hate getting that stuff wrong. Okay, the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, The Ring. According to Box Office Mojo, how many horror movies are in the top 25 all-time money earners with the word ring in the title? And to be more clear about this, I'm talking about the top 25 horror movies, not the top 25 list in general that included Star Wars and Titanic and Sound of Music, but the top 25 horror movies specifically have ring in their title.
So I kind of have to guess because I had a really hard time finding specifically horror movies. Box Office Mojo splits it up by horror, paranormal, or horror, slasher. So I'm guessing that it is The Ring, The Ring 2, The Conjuring, and The Conjuring 2.
You did it well.
Nice.
Yeah, in order, The Ring, The Conjuring 2, and The Ring 2. They were in the top 20, but I included 25 just for the hell of it. Not my best work for trivia questions of all time, so let's just move on. But well done. The Next 100 Project's 79th title, The Ring, was not recognized in any way by any AFI list. DreamWorks sicked this freaky product on the public a few days shy of 15 years ago on October 18th, 2002. Its box office receipts nearly tripled its budget. And unlike most big hits these days, it made more money in week two than it did in week one, and that is thanks to a slow release pattern, which you really don't see much anymore. This movie did creep its way into the public consciousness.
I had a great word of mouth. I remember this movie being recommended to me a lot.
Well, tell people what it's about, Bev, with the skinny.
Naomi Watts is Rachel, an investigative journalist who, following the mysterious death of her niece, gets sucked into an urban legend about a videotape that kills anyone who watches it after 7 days. She gets in deeper, and the stakes get higher as the evidence supporting the legend piles up, and the malevolent spirit behind the tape gets closer and closer to Rachel and her son.
Or, in a nutshell, perpetually angry filmmaker gains immortality using antiquated technology. She's a good filmmaker, though, isn't she?
It wasn't antiquated at the time.
Well, it is now.
Oh, yeah, it sure is.
Or, reporter and her freaky son take up video piracy to save their own skins, specifically his skin. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers are not good at all. It's the worst we've seen, maybe ever, in doing this podcast. 71% of critics like the movie, 146 fresh and 57 rotten, but only 48% of audiences. So the critics didn't love the movie that much. It was okay with them, but the audiences really took a dump on it. It was 18th at the 2002 U.S. box office. Spider-Man was number one, and a movie we covered quite a few months ago, Chicago, was the 10th best picture on the Box Office Mojo list of 2002. The movie cost less than $50 million to make, but it did gross $129 million, and it made twice that worldwide. So, in all measures, this movie was a huge hit. And also, Quentin Tarantino must have loved this movie because it's a revenge flick. Samara wants revenge more than anything else. And one of the better twists in the whole film, we'll talk about that later on. What did you think on your second, and also my second, viewing of The Ring?
Well, when I first saw The Ring back in 2002, it scared the living daylights out of me. I had trouble sleeping for days. This time around, the effect was completely lost on me. I was barely scared at all. But I still enjoyed what is a well-shot, well-acted, well-written horror film with a compelling mystery and a very adept twist at the end.
One of the better twists of any horror film. I didn't love this movie the first time I saw it. I was not as affected as you were, but you did say 2 weeks ago when we did Get Out that the movie affected you, and it seemed to affect you more than it did me. Except I did admit, as I've always admitted about this movie, when I went to sleep that night, I looked into the living room, my bed would face the TV, and I imagined Samara coming out of the TV. So just like The Grudge, which I actually flat out hated, which was a couple years after this movie, I can't deny that when I went to sleep that night, the movies lingered with me. And that's always my mark for a horror film. But it sounds like you slept well, and I did that night. Just like when I watched It a few days ago, the big hit in the box office right now. It was an effective movie, but it didn't bother me later that night. I'm also 43 years old, so maybe horror movies don't really affect me the same way.
I think I did my share of mental preparation for it, because I didn't want to get scared, so I had been thinking about it, and was ready for all the scares when they happened. But it really didn't get under my skin at all, which amazes me, because I'm telling you, when I saw it the first time, I saw it on DVD, at home in my bedroom, and we were going through the special features afterwards, and we clicked on something on the DVD that just played the video from the movie. It starts, and at first I'm trying to be cool as it goes on. I was like, you know what, I can't watch it. Turn it off. And my boyfriend at the time is like, I'm trying. Like, he's legitimately pressing stop, pressing everything on the DVD player, pressing the power button. Everything was disabled. I don't know how this even happened. I was losing my shit until we finally, and I am not proud to admit this, unplugged the player to make it stop.
And it kept playing, didn't it?
No, that finally did it. Probably messed up some of my settings while we were at it, but I was so scared I had to do something that dramatic to make it stop.
The video that changes whenever somebody new watches it, although obviously on the DVD it would be the same video every time, but that's one of the nice touches of this film that I don't think I remember from before. But I noticed at this time that it does look a little different each time somebody watches it. So it's this evil, adaptable videotape.
Because I guess it's not really necessarily on the tape. It's just Samara.
Mm-hmm. Samara's George Lucas. Leave your masterpiece alone!
When you think about the details here and there, you can really easily pick apart all the holes in the plot. But one of the things that I just think is funny is, if you're Samara and you ultimately want revenge and to aid that goal, it would help to be freed from the well. You can make any film. Why not just look directly into camera and be like, my name is Samara. My mother murdered me. My body is trapped in this well. Please help me reach heaven or whatever. Free my soul. Why wouldn't she just do that rather than play out these elaborate murder plots?
Well, the video was created long after she died. Isn't that the suggestion? She's an evil spirit, and that's one of the things they show when she's still alive. And then Aiden, the son of Naomi Watts in the movie, David Dorfman, plays him pretty well, by the way, make very clear that she's an evil person when she's alive, and she's very much evil as a spirit. She's not looking for closure. She wants to hurt and kill anybody.
Yeah, which was true when she was alive as well. The video had to have existed for a while because it was an urban legend. It probably could have been seen by countless people who died in accidental circumstances or whatever they were calling it, the excuses they made for all these teenagers' deaths. But for all we know, people have been dying for years from watching the video, from being haunted by her. But the first person to really put it together was Rachel.
I'm guessing it's probably black people, because just like in Get Out, they don't count the same way, so no one reports on those deaths. But when it's a wealthy young girl, Amber Tamblyn, then we care.
As you say that, I'm trying to rack my brain and think, were there very many black people in this movie? Like, where is it supposed to take place? The Pacific Northwest?
I think in the Seattle area, somewhere in Washington.
Yeah, the Pacific Northwest does not have a large non-white population, so...
Oh, it's just a joke anyway. Yeah. I'm not suggesting that. Well, we're on the video here. Let's talk about my reasonably good questions. You had quite a few of them last week, well, 2 weeks ago with Get Out. I've got a lot for this movie, and they're mostly about the video. Why does everyone watch that video from about 10 inches away?
Because it looks cool, Ryan.
That's exactly the answer. That's the only answer there is. Naomi Watts does
like
it. Martin
Anderson
does it.
Like a grown woman is kneeling in front of the television.
Need some glasses. What if you watched the video where there was no phone service and Samara can't call you? Does it still count? Is the contract still in play?
Where is there a TV and a VCR and no phone, though?
But what if the phone service was out? Do you have to watch the entire video for Samara to vow to kill you? I have an answer for my own question about this one. I was just reading a few minutes ago, in fact, the plot for The Ring 2,
yeah,
which still stars Watts and Dorfman. And in that one, apparently, I don't remember this at all, but in the opening, there's these random characters, just like in this movie, the two characters we see, and they don't really matter. They set up the plot. The girl who watches the videotape, and it's a setup from her friend, boyfriend, whatever it is, wants her to watch it, so she'll be the one who's now attacked, and he'll be freed, but she closes her eyes, so Samara comes for him. So I guess the sequel answers that very question, although we have to go by the logic of the first movie, so my point still remains, if you don't watch the whole thing, what happens then? What if you just didn't answer the phone? Is the death contract still valid?
Yes, it is, because Aiden never answers the phone. Does Noah answer the phone?
Well, Noah's the one who calls when Rachel thinks that's going to be Samara on the other end of the phone. Leave him alone! Rachel? Yeah, our son saw the tape! Big plot twist right there.
Someone else has already called, though, and left a message, and then she deletes the message, so it can never be heard. So I guess we don't know. Maybe that's the reason Aiden was okay.
But they also made a copy. Let's finish up my reasonably good questions, because I only have a few more, and they're all about the tape. If everyone shared the tape, would it be down to just one death worldwide? If everyone cooperated, I guess it'd just be one person that Samara kills.
One unlucky person. And billions Samara of people. Would be so disappointed. Who am I going to kill now?
My last question is this a subtle lesson to Rachel about why she shouldn't murder her weird child? Because Samara is murdered by her mother for being a weird child.
But she's murdered because she's not just a weird child. She's a weird child who compels all these innocent horses to kill themselves and is presumably driving her parents mad with her psychic powers. And Aiden also has psychic powers and is a totally weird, creepy kid. As the mystery unfolds, we're led to believe that Samara was the victim of cruel neglect, left to live with the horses and only a television to keep her company. As we're learning that, Rachel is also actively neglecting her son in pursuit of the answers to the mystery. And of course, later we learn that Samara's mother tried to kill her to protect the world from her powerful evil impulses. So, Aiden has psychic powers, he's clairvoyant, and he is creepy. Is there an implication that the world needs protecting from him? Maybe she should be killing Aiden. Although, I guess do it in a different way so that he doesn't die with this need to kill people with his spirit? I don't have the answer.
Which kid is creepier, Aiden or Samara?
Oh, Samara, give me a break. She is one of the creepiest characters in cinema. That is one thing the film does amazing, is she is terrifying. Now, they copied her almost in every possible way from the original.
We have Ringu. Talked about
the Japanese film, which was tremendously popular in Japan, and that The Ring was very loyally a remake of.
It was, yeah.
In one way especially, and that is the everything production design regarding Samara. The dress, the hair, the way she moves her body, the missing fingernails. All these little details are pulled directly from Ringu.
We rented the movie because we didn't own it and figured I might as well just watch it on DVD. And the clerk said to me as I was paying for it, you ever heard of Ringu? You should watch that instead. Well, we want to see the English language version, but yes, I've heard of it and saw it. I saw Ringu years later and thought it was fine, but because I didn't love the original movie... And yeah, Ringu is probably better, but I had seen the same basic thing. So Ringu is the one you have to recommend, I guess, if you're going to watch either of them. But then how many people really want to watch foreign language films? And especially when the remake is mostly the same movie.
I did watch some clips from Ringu. And yeah, it's hard to say. I haven't seen it. No matter what, whichever one you watch first is the one you're going to like better. Because that's the one that's going to have all the initial effect and fear on you, especially because they're so similar. I want to add, though, that the video store where we rented it is the movie version of High Fidelity. Mm-hmm. It's this independent video store. It's the reason why it's one of the very few video stores that are still
Queen
open
Video.
In this city.
Kudos to them.
Oh, no, they're amazing.
Place to rent from. Big kudos to Queen Video and Bay Street Video, both on Bloor in Toronto. Not many places left you can rent from or even buy from in this goddamn city anymore. But they provided movies for us to rent, and we'll probably have to rent from them again because I don't really love the idea of downloading. I'd rather be able to see it on a physical copy. I'm a little bit old school that way, I guess.
And they are a place that employs people who are so passionate about movies that they'll stop you from renting the movie you want and try to recommend the original Japanese version.
So as for the title of The Ring, it's like Get Out, which we did 2 weeks ago. It's a multiple meaning title. There's the phone ringing whenever Samara is going to threaten people. The light at the top of the well, which is the last thing she ever sees, is a ring.
That's a pretty interesting reveal, because you never really know what it is until near the end when Naomi Watts is trapped in the well herself, and you see the lid go back on, and then you put those pieces together. Terrifying, cruel meaning.
And before you die, you see the ring, which she says in the film. It also refers to the cyclical plot, because you pass on the tape or you die, so it's this ring of death, or even survival, I guess is maybe a better way of putting it. As long as you pass on the tape, you survive. Originally, the video that they produced to promote the movie was a commercial. And I guess they showed the video in its entirety, but it was unclear there was going to be a movie. And that's a great way to start getting your movie out there to the public. Some cinemas gave away the tape in theaters in the United States and Canada as well.
Oh, that's so cruel.
Plays back to William Castle's techniques back in, I think, the 50s and 60s. He was a schlock filmmaker, but he'd do all kinds of crazy things to get people to come watch his movies. Now, this isn't quite on the schlock level. Obviously, they're putting a lot of money into giveaway tapes. And that's one of the big influences from this film, was the marketing. It was brilliant.
Well, it was only a few short years after the really brilliant marketing of Blair Witch Project. Mm-hmm. And I think probably a lot of studios after that were trying to find an angle, trying to find a gimmick that would get butts in the theater. And it's particularly effective with horror films, where mystery is such a key. So you can meet out these little details and get people interested and can lure them in. And it worked. I mean, it got butts in the seats. This movie was tremendously successful.
There were some important deleted scenes that I tried to watch, but the DVD we rented didn't have them. So I just have to refer to them from what I've read online. Samara apparently was brutally beaten with a rock in a deleted scene. And I guess that suggests that her mother wanted to make sure she died. Because in the movie, she just strangles her with a bag over her head. And it's implied that's enough. And then she pitches her down the well. The other deleted scene that's important, which I wish I could have watched, is Chris Cooper. Yes, that Chris Cooper, who the same year won an Oscar for adaptation. He's supposed to be a child molester who approaches Rachel in the beginning to say, I didn't actually do it, or I'm sorry, whatever it was. But he wants forgiveness. And then at the end, I think it's supposed to be that he's the one that they give the tape to, that Aiden copies, because he's got to pay for his crimes kind of deal. And I don't know why they cut his scenes up, but I did read at one point that he was so good that it offset the movie a little bit much with his performance. And let me bring in the star we barely talked about, Naomi Watts, who I love. I've raved about her so much. Mulholland Drive we did last year. We talked about the performance she gave in King Kong, which was a couple years after that. And I've loved her in so many movies, but I don't think she's great in this movie, actually. I think at the very beginning more so, because I think she gets better as it goes along. She's uneven. And that's not the greatest thing you can say about an actress in a horror film. You could also say that about the lead actress in the original Nightmare on Elm Street, Heather Langenkamp, that she's a little bit uneven at times.
Yeah, it's strange how at the beginning of the film, when we're introduced to the character of Rachel, is to learn that she's late picking up her son, and her teacher's concerned about him, and she mouths off to her, and she seems like this kind of a screw-up. She has this kid who's clearly super smart and weird and needs some extra care, and it almost seems like he's looking after her a little bit. But then in every scene after that, yes, she's not necessarily looking after her son. She kind of puts him on the back burner, but she's a very competent and confident woman who's extremely good at her job and applying those skills to solving this mystery, a mystery that's been going on for, as far as we know, for decades, and she's the first person to really get to the bottom of it. And we see her over and over be strong and intelligent and capable, so that scene's really a misleading introduction of her.
Also, she undersells the grief about the supposedly close niece dying.
Yeah, what the hell?
She seems to barely care, and they implied that she was not only related to this girl, which is one thing, but she was very close to her.
It was her sister's daughter!
But I mean, she actually really liked her, because you could imply in a movie, okay, my relative died, but oh well. No, this one mattered to her, because she took care of her son, and they were close. But she doesn't seem to really give a shit.
Although that is the motive for her to get to the bottom of the answer of the tape, but they don't really draw it out all that well. They don't really make the connection that she's heartbroken about losing her niece, and something that's an absolute tragedy. Even at the funeral, she seems way, way, way more concerned about her son, which is fair, that she's worried that Aiden is taking it poorly, and she's worried about her sister. But yeah, you're right, there's no personal connection that she has to her teenage niece who died tragically and horribly.
So either Gore Verbinski, the director, or she really dropped the ball there. And I love Naomi Watts, so I'm going to have to guess it's maybe his fault. By the way, Watts is now 49 years old, believe it or not. She still looks great. She's still a great actress. So that would have made her in her mid-30s at this point. And she'd hit it big the year before Mulholland Drive. Well, maybe didn't hit it big because the movie wasn't a big hit, but it was on the radar. And then she started getting movies like this. And then King Kong, because of her performance in that art house hit, Mulholland Drive, for Lynch after working for so long in obscurity. And this role could have been given to Jennifer Connelly, Jennifer Love Hewitt, I'm not a fan of hers, Gwyneth Paltrow, Kate Beckinsale, and most of them would have been pretty good in the role, and since I'm actually kind of slamming Naomi a little bit here, maybe some of them would have been even better. But Watts does level up pretty well, and for more than three quarters of the movie, she's fine. It's more of that first 10 minutes of screen time she has at the most where you gotta say, what the fuck's going on here? As for the bad guy, Samara, these days, she would have had to text her threat to kill you in a week. There'd be no phone calls, because who would answer their goddamn phone?
It would have been on YouTube instead of a videotape.
She would have killed a lot more people that way. She just wants to kill. She does understand teens, though, because the whole thing is, don't watch this tape, it's going to kill you. So, of course, reverse psychology, teens are going to watch it when they're told not to.
Although, you know what, the teens that watch it, she explains pretty clearly, we thought we had taped the game, but this is what was on the tape instead.
But still, I'm saying that if teens were told not to do something by anybody, they would probably do it more so than if they weren't told not to.
You say that, but who was told not to and still watched it? Rachel and Noah. Two total grown-ups. Parents!
Well, they're idiots then. Am I wrong about teens? Am I wrong about human nature, really? No. Don't do something! Okay, I will. I like the concept that you pay for having leisure time and watching movies, and also for snooping, which is what Rachel's doing. So if you have leisure time, or if you're a snooper, you die, or at least you're threatened with death.
I like the art film as a menace, because it is such an arty film. It's a very abstract film. Samara's difficult childhood turned her into a moody emo artist, making dramatic abstract art film about her parents.
And Noah even says as much when he talks about what he saw.
Yeah. I don't know if this was intentional, but I like the parallel between the process Rachel goes through to decipher the clues left in the tape. It's similar to the process we all go through when we watch a particularly abstract piece of art. It's initially confounding, but if you pay close attention to the symbolism, watch it over and over, and pay attention to the feeling that a piece gives you, you can work to determine the intended meaning. This isn't for everybody, but I find a real joy in this process, and I think that a large part of the appeal of art is that you kind of have to solve a mystery sometimes, and the artist leaves clues for us to follow. Every filmmaker does this in one way or another, but the more abstract the film is, the higher the degree of difficulty. And, I mean, if Samara can make a film, like I said, why not just make a film where she looks dark at the camera and explains that her mother murdered her. But here she made this visual poetry that needs to be studied to be fully appreciated. So there's a parallel of solving the mystery with the experience of solving the mystery of an abstract piece of art. And perhaps I was thinking about this because we saw Mother last weekend, which definitely requires a great deal of interpretation. I enjoyed it. I know it's not for everybody. Part of the joy of the movie is solving the mystery that's presented to you with all the symbolism.
Just like in It, which I saw a few days after we saw Mother together.
And that has that aspect as well?
Well, not nearly as much as the video within the movie in The Ring or in Mother, but there's an element of subtext in any horror film, and It does it fine. Not as well as some of the movies we've covered this month, but there's definitely subtext going on there.
And speaking of mystery, I mean, the mystery is the bulk of this movie. One of the things that Verbinski does so well is he lets it pace out really slowly. He lets us learn information bit by bit and just kind of learn as our heroes learn what's going on. He takes his time. He lets the creepiness factor build up. And a lot of people complimented this, that it's not just that the pacing was good, it's that the pacing was in total stark difference from what was being released as horror films at the time. It's easy to forget that in 2002... everything in theaters was a Scream movie or something trying to capitalize on what Scream did. It was the same thing over and over in a lot of serial killer movies. And there weren't that many occult horror films. Of course, that changed immediately after The Ring came out. And I think we still get a lot more occult films. They still release them every year. There's ghost movies. But this was a fairly new and refreshing film when it came out. Of course, it wasn't new in the world because it's a rehash of things that have been done in cinema since the beginning of cinema, but it was also a very popular genre in Japan already.
The J-horror thing, and that's one of the big influences from The Ring, is that J-horror came to America with this, and then later on Dark Water, which was mediocre. Jennifer Connelly, I mentioned her, was in that. And then, of course, The Grudge, which was only a few years after this movie, which for all of its flaws does have some pretty creepy moments, including the girl crawling down the stairs.
Mm-hmm. They call it the Dark Wet Girl. Oh, no, sorry, the Dead Wet Girl. That's what it is. It's the Dead Wet Girl, who is like a staple of Japanese horror, still to this day. Ringu, the film this is based on, there's been 9 films now. And the film that The Grudge was based on is up to 12, so much so that there was actually a crossover last year. There's a film that was made where Samara and the character from The Grudge fight. Yes, they fight each other.
Yeah, fuck them both.
Just like Freddy fucking and bitches. Jason.
You mentioned the Dead What Girl. The whole Morgan family, including Brian Cox's character, who plays the father, very brief role, but effective. And I mentioned adaptation that Chris Cooper was in. He was also in adaptation this same year, 2002. But the whole Morgan family dies in water. Samara dies in the well. The mother pitches herself into the ocean and commits suicide. And then Brian Cox commits suicide in the bathtub.
The horses also drown themselves. The horse that Rachel spooks on the ferry.
Creepy scene.
Jumps into the water. I think the horse probably dies by getting ground up in the gears of the boat.
But it would have drowned anyway.
Yeah, it would have drowned. It's raining all the time. And water's always seeping up on the floor around television sets whenever Samara is near.
Or dripping off doorknobs.
Yeah, so there's a Japanese folk myth that water is the means by which a soul travels between worlds, the world of the living and the dead. Which we kind of saw a little bit in Spirited Away. The water is a very big component of Spirited Away. It's like a Japanese thing that's from the original.
And that was also this same year, 2002.
And what do you know?
And we covered that earlier this year. One thing that really failed the first time for me was, I don't know what it was, but it made me laugh. And it was the countdown to death. And the funny thing is that The Shining did this by showing us the day of the week, and Seven did it as well. 7 days. But showing the Monday and the Tuesday and the Wednesday and all that stuff, I remember literally having to suppress a giggle, because it just seemed funny to me that there's a countdown to Rachel's death.
It's very dramatic. They have the big musical hit that comes with it. To doom!
And I didn't laugh this time, so I guess I was in a weird mood that day. But one thing that is very effective in this film, the death makeup and effects, for that matter, on Amber Tamblyn and Martin Henderson. We freeze-framed it, and it looks damn good. Probably they stretched out the mouth post-production, but it's also just some cool makeup on them.
Yeah, it's tremendously effective and just terrifying.
So how about the climax? And of course, that's where the story begins, is where it ends in a way, because when Samara is killed, that's where all this starts in the first place. Cabin 12, where Rachel finds the tape and views it, and that's built over the well. I'd forgotten that one thing. I've actually read about this movie over the years quite a bit. I haven't watched it in all these years, but I knew a lot about it and watched some of the clips. Probably why it didn't affect me as well, seeing it a second time. But I forgot that detail, that Cabin 12 ends up being a key moment because it's over the well. How in the living Christ did Rachel survive falling into that well the way she does? Her neck should be broken, her back should be broken.
Yeah.
Regardless, she falls even 10 feet the way she does, face first, she should be dead. But you mentioned it before, it's a clever fake-out ending. It's one of the better twist endings in any horror film, maybe ever. Having Rachel give Samara a piece, you think the movie's over, she goes and tells Aiden that, and then one of the creepiest moments in the whole film is him looking at her and say, "You shouldn't have done that. No, that's bad." Because Samara will not stop. So then the question becomes, if it's not going to be Chris Cooper's deleted scene character, who did Rachel show the videotape that Aiden copied? I suggest maybe her boss at the newspaper.
I thought I remembered a scene where she takes it back and puts it back on the shelf.
They say online she did that. It's not shown in the movie.
Oh, okay. Because I like that ending better than her giving it to the child molester. There's this implication that she would go this far. She knows it's just like a random person. She has no idea who's going to ultimately watch it.
Aiden even asks her.
She would go this far to save her son.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. Aiden asks her, "Please be accountable for what you're doing."
And she doesn't answer.
Because you're killing someone instead of me.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just like, "Shh, shh, shh, don't think about it."
Can you really blame her?
No, of course I can't blame her. It's what you would do. It's kind of like a nice thing that we think, well, what would we do? We probably would sooner see a stranger die than our child.
Yep.
She wouldn't necessarily do it to save herself. I couldn't see her doing that necessarily.
But she is saved by making the copy that she showed to Noah, the father of her child. Martin Henderson is Noah. He was in Smoke and Aces and did a lot of TV, but not any other big roles. David Dorfman as that kid was in the sequel, along with Naomi Watts. And then Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 2003, the very next year after this movie. And his last movie was Drillbit Taylor. He was a pretty good child actor. I don't know where he went to after Drillbit Taylor, but he hasn't been in a movie since then, a long time ago.
Yeah, maybe he just decided he didn't really like acting enough to do it as his career.
Jane Alexander's in one scene as a doctor. We've covered her in All the President's Men and Kramer vs. Kramer in some of our podcasts. She's done a ton of TV shows and movies. But the biggest part of the movie, other than the main two characters, the mother and son, would be, of course, Samara DeVay Chase, who was in Spirited Away, which we covered quite a few months ago this year. She was Lilo in Lilo and Stitch. And then she was Donnie Darko's younger sister in Donnie Darko.
And anyone who watched Big Love like I did will remember her as Rhonda, the totally creepy, devout member of the church and the leader's youngest wife who wants to be a pop star. And she is just this delightfully awful, narcissistic psychopath child. She's a great character on that show.
She plays a good villain. She's one of the better child villains we've seen, along with maybe Reagan and The Exorcist. Of course, Linda Blair's got more of a meaty part, and she's got a lot of screen time. When you watch the extra footage on The Exorcist, you'll see, or hear, actually, more so, Linda Blair's voice doing exactly what Mercedes McCambridge would later do with the voice. And it's still pretty effective. It isn't quite as effective as the deeper, older woman's voice. But, hey, DeVay Chase is on the list of great child villains in horror movies. And I like the concept that she is not going to be put to rest. She wants to kill. It doesn't matter what you do. You can put her bones to rest and solve this mystery, but fuck you, I still want to kill, and I still will.
I love that twist. I didn't see it coming at all. I thought the movie was over. They did such a convincing job of wrapping it up. And then it's so scary all over again. I think the twist is one of the best things about the movie. And I think one of the additional things that makes DeVay Chase so scary is there's something extra creepy about what a chubby-cheeked face she has, you know? She just has such a childlike, cute face, but she really pulls off this sinister way about her with the hair, with the motion, the way she moves, and everything about her.
Well, and that's also cutting out some frames from the film, and then, of course, special effects post-production makes that work so well.
Yeah.
But she does sell it pretty well. Of course, the hair over the face is something they did in the Scary Movie sequels, where she's one of the villains in those movies. And they kind of ruin it a little bit, but I don't blame them because it was such an iconic figure of the hair over the face walking towards you and coming to kill you.
I saw another thing about Japanese tradition, because that's copied from the Japanese film. In Japanese culture, it's a respectful gesture for women to wear their hair up and back, and that the looser your hair is, the more counter society you are. So for her to have such crazy hair and to have it so much in her face is a tremendously rebellious thing to do.
So it works on many levels, because it's what you just said, but also you can't see her face, except when they do show her coming after Noah, the hair parts enough you can see the crazy eyes looking out. And I guess she just scares people to death. She doesn't actually seem to attack them. Unless she wants to suggest she's pulling their mouths open, but there's no blood.
Well,
she stops their heart somehow.
The teenager, yeah, it was that she had a heart attack.
And that seems to be what happened to Noah as well. Okay, well, the director of all these cast members is Gore Verbinski, who, of course, went on to the Pirates movies and made a fortune doing those, and then lost some of that fortune, probably for some studios, with The Lone Ranger. He's done no other horror movies after this one until this year's A Cure for Wellness, which is listed as a horror film, but it's probably more fantasy from what I was understanding about that. And it was a dud. Nobody saw it, so that didn't really succeed the way that The Ring had. But you'd think that he would keep on making movies like this when he was so good at it, except it was only the very next year he made Pirates of the Caribbean, which was such a blockbuster, and then he made two sequels. So maybe he never thought he'd bother to go back to these.
Yeah, I think he could just print money after that point.
He's been very successful in his entire career, really, like him or not. Made Rango, which won the Oscar for animated film that year, and it was given to him, so he's an Oscar winner. The visuals in this movie were based on Andrew Wyeth paintings, according to the internet, and I wondered, did Andrew Wyeth love sickly green? The movie is very green and not a very pretty one at that.
It's also shortly after The Matrix came out, and I think everything was a little bit green after that, because that was such a trend-setting film.
The writer was Aaron Kruger, who did write the sequel and the Transformers sequels, and Scott Frank, who wrote Get Shorty and also Minority Report, did rewrites. So it's one of those things, whenever you read that kind of deal, maybe it's Aaron Kruger's story, well, based on something else, but maybe it's Aaron Kruger's screenplay, but it sounds like it could be more Scott Frank's screenplay. So if you like it, give both of them credit, I guess. And they based it on Koji Suzuki's book and Hiroshi Takahashi's 1998 Ringu from Japan. The producers were Laurie MacDonald and Walter Parks, who both worked a lot with Spielberg and obviously had one of their biggest hits with this movie. The movie was 185-1, and we did rent the movie from Queen Video, so thanks to them. The cinematographer, Bohan Bezzelli, he also shot Mr. and Mrs. Smith and The Lone Ranger for Verbinski. The editor, Craig Wood, he always cuts for Gore Verbinski, and he also did cut Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2. And I always like to ask you what you thought of the editing, so what about this one? A horror film needs good editing, like in Get Out a couple weeks ago. Was it good? Was it bad? Was it okay?
I think it's flawless. The pace is one of the best things about the film.
It's not overly long. It's about an hour and 50-ish, I guess. That's fine for a length of a movie.
But it lets it take its time. They don't rush anything. And there could be a great temptation to rush things in a film that needs to set such a slow pace. But it never feels boring.
That's true. It builds mystery quite well. It's almost like a noir film in some ways, in building that mystery.
Certainly the way it's so bleak with all the rain, for sure.
Mm. And the composer, Hans Zimmer, who we've covered quite a bit in the last couple of years because he did Thelma and Louise, and of course The Lion King, which was not that long ago for us, the Pirates movies, or at least the first one anyway, and mostly with Christopher Nolan the last couple of years. But the guy's composed for, I think, 173 or 583 or 2012 movies the last 10 or 20 or 30 years.
And this movie certainly has his signature big moment, big boom, where when you have the reveal of the bodies, when you have the reveal of the days of the week.
Yeah.
Each time that title page comes up.
Not subtle.
Yeah.
About The Influence, of course, there was the sequel, The Ring 2, and then this year's Rings, or was that last year? Hell, I don't remember now. I didn't see it. I will see it when it's free on demand, but I haven't seen it yet. It was a huge seller on DVD. Everybody wanted to own it and freak themselves out, I think, because it was part of the thrill of it, was let's watch this movie and then go to sleep afterwards, or maybe not go to sleep afterwards, because we're going to die in 7 days.
I don't think we should gloss over the stylistic influence that The Ring had. Now, of course, it didn't invent any of these things. It stole them all from J-horror, but like I was saying earlier, from now on, movies could be a lot more supernatural, but they could also be a lot more creepy and slow-paced, and they could have that more kind of David Lynch sound design with all those creepy sounds that go along with the monsters. Of course, they weren't brand new, but they were certainly a trendy and popular thing after this happened, and I think you still see that influence in horror films.
A recent horror favorite of ours, It Follows, has a similar Pass on the Curse theme.
Yes.
And in both cases, the horror is not over when the movie's over.
I've been thinking about It Follows quite a bit since we saw this movie. Different tones in many ways, but yeah, it has that same, you have to screw someone else over in order to save yourself.
Like. It Follows literally screw someone else. The awards in this section is almost nothing. It was nominated for no Oscars. It did win a few Saturns and Fangoria awards for what that's worth. And like I said at the top of the podcast, nothing on the AFI, although I think maybe if the Throws List had come out after this, it might have been nominated for the top 400 at least, but I wouldn't have made it. I mean, the Throws List was already pretty good, and I've criticized some of the selections on there, but they didn't really honor too many horror films, bona fide horror, like The Exorcist, Night of the Living Dead's on there, but there aren't that many other horror films. But regardless, this couldn't have been nominated. It came out too late. Your final thoughts on The Ring?
At its heart, The Ring is kind of a campy horror film, but it's really elevated by committed performances, Verbinski's inspired visuals and great adept directing.
Green visuals.
And that amazing about-face twist at the end.
Yeah, kudos.
Maybe not a great film, but a very good film that deserves credit for turning the tide on horror films in America in the 21st century.
I think I liked it more the second time, even though I won't deny that it did affect me the first time, because I do respect what it was trying to do and how it worked on people, even if it wasn't on me so much. But it's funny how we both said at the top, and we'll say it again, it didn't really affect us and scare us this time like we both thought it might.
It is still to this day, 15 years later, a pretty strong part of the cultural zeitgeist. The image of Samara crawling out of a TV screen is now forever a iconic image of horror.
Sure. And I'm surprised you didn't mention this. The hero and the villain are both ladies.
Oh, yeah, of course. That's right.
We've got that later on in the month. Well, not so much the... Well, not again. The Babadook has a female hero, but is she also maybe the villain? But our next film has no women whatsoever. We're certainly going to talk about that when we get to it. And it is next week. When we make our horrifying return on Monday, we'll travel back to 1982 and gander at John Carpenter's creature classic, and at the time, pissed on, but now beloved, The Thing. Dun, dun. Dun, dun. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for The Thing. Fans of this movie probably know this one. But here we go. At the end of the movie, is Kurt Russell the Thing? Is Keith David the Thing? Or is neither of them the Thing?
For the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about The Thing. And if you just can't wait that long to hear from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered well over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made. Every episode is available for free. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. And don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT. One word, TOP100PROJECT. No case sensitive.
Copy my tape. Video piracy lives on, but VHS does not.
And cut.